Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Midtown Atlanta, it's time for Top Docs Radio, brought to you by Medical Association of Georgia. With over 7,800 physician members, MAG is pleased to advocate on behalf of Georgia's patients and physicians. Visit MAG.org and on Twitter at MAG1849. Join the conversation on Twitter at Top Docs on BRX.
Hello, everyone. It is C.W. Hall, your host here on the Top Docs Radio Show. Pleased to have you with us today. Thanks to the Medical Association of Georgia for making this episode available to you. They've been a great partner along the way. And a few years ago, I was hosting another program, Health Connect South Radio. We were just kicking that show off and it ran for 72 episodes. And our first one, we had a panel of individuals from around the Atlanta metro area talking about cancer from a variety of perspectives. And I was pleased to have the chance at that point in time to meet Dr. Lynn Lichtenfeld. He's the Deputy Chief Medical Officer with the Office of the Chief Medical Officer for the American Cancer Society. He was a practicing physician for nearly 20 years as an internist and oncologist. Of course, he's been active in the development of healthcare policy at local, state, and national level throughout his career. Been doing a lot of good work at the American Cancer Society. So I'm really pleased to have you take some time to join in the studio with us and talk about where we're at with cancer today.
Well, thanks so much. And it really is a pleasure to be back here with you.
We were talking a little bit before we went on the air today about kind of where this all started, to come to a little bit more of a focus with a little bit more of a vector. Where are we going? What are we trying to do? Putting that behind the effort to understand cancer, what causes it if we can, and then I guess at that point be able to more effectively treat it. And that was the moonshot back in the 70s.
It was actually the beginning of what was called the War on Cancer. And of course, now it's been changed to the moonshot, which, it's a different time, different era, different things to do. But we've been at this a long time. I mean, clearly we've been engaged in cancer care and cancer research for a long time, but the modern era, yes, it's probably started with that moonshot effort from President Nixon at the time, and it's been a long journey, and it's still very much at the beginning of the journey. We're not at the end. We still have a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm. And so you were talking about some of the early work that it was beginning back in the 70s and 80s, immunosuppressive therapies, things like that starting to come onto the radar. Where are we in the evolution of those things? It seems to me, I'm not very versed yet in cancer. My background really was in cardiovascular medicine as an RN in critical care. But from what I understand, those types of treatments are showing some measure of promise in particular areas anyway.
Well, CW, that's a fascinating story, and I won't bore you with all the details because it's a long story. We could spend a long time talking about it. But the reality is that the story I like to tell is that we actually, I was doing immunotherapy research back in the 1970s, back in 1972 and 1973 in that arena. So when you think about it, the story that I like to tell that most people are aware of, President Carter, former President Carter, who's obviously a Georgia native, had melanoma, and he got immunotherapy as part of his treatment. Having said that, the research that led to his treatment started a little bit before the 1970s, but really started to take off in the 1970s. And it didn't get approved until the last couple of years. It's really been since about 2010 that we've had some drugs that have been very effective as immune modulating agents, improved the immune response. And the drug that President Carter got for his melanoma had just been approved. The research that actually led to that took decades to get to where it was. So I think it's an important lesson. We want to speed up cancer research. I mean, Vice President Biden, who had the moonshot, and everybody's sort of heard about that. And by the way, he's given some excellent talks that are on YouTube and other venues about the importance of research. He wants to accelerate research. He wants to make happen in 5 years what used to happen in 10 years. It has taken us a long time and will continue to take a long time to make those discoveries. We can't let up. We have to continue working to do the basic science to get these newer treatments. But where we are today, it's actually, and I try not to be to over-promise and under-deliver the way some other folks have over the years, but the reality is I'm very excited about what's happening in cancer care in 2017 and in this particular era.
When we're talking about immunotherapy, is that the notion that I am training my own immune system to recognize that this cancer cell shouldn't be here and go after it like it would an infection. Is it similar to that?
It absolutely is. Way back in the 1960s, we began to understand that cancer cells had unique antigens, had unique markers on their surface that should have theoretically helped our immune system recognize them and deal with them. And in fact, we do think and we do know that on a regular basis, there are cells within our bodies that become, quote, cancer, and we get rid of them. Otherwise, you know, with all the cell divisions and things that happen to us, we would have a lot more cancer. So we still have it, unfortunately, too much, but we don't have as much as we would have had otherwise. So our immune systems do function. But in some circumstances, those cells are pretty smart. They're smart in a lot of ways, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And they evade the immune system, or they, in some situations, as we now know, they sort of put that immune system to sleep. These newer drugs sort of help the immune system wake up. And by waking up, they can attack some of those cancer cells in some of the patients, not enough of the patients, but in some patients, and actually put those patients, if not into remission, can stabilize them for actually what's turned out to be significantly long periods of time.
That's intriguing. I never really had conceived of the notion that the cancer cells may be able to emit either a hormone or some other chemical that would either make itself invisible to the
Well, they actually attack the cell. I mean, our immune system, you know, we face things every day.
Right.
We have viruses, we have bacteria, we have things in our environment. And somehow our body, for the most part, deals with it. If you transplant an organ, and most people know, if you put a kidney in, you know, our immune system will recognize that's not my kidney, and it will go after it. So we have to sort of, in that case, we have to tamp down the immune system.
Right.
So, but our bodies recognize those things, and then they literally, as cells, will attack them and, I hate to say, gobble them up. That sounds sort of simple, but that's in essence what happens.
Right.
And the cancer cells have these little, you know, have these little signals that they send to other cells, to the normal immune cells, and they put those cells to sleep. They stop working and they don't recognize the cancer cells. So the trick was, how do you unmask that and make the system go back to normal?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, we thought, melanoma, we've known for decades, we thought there was a way to do that. Kidney cancer, we thought there was a way to do that. But what's been surprising in this current era is it's not just melanoma, it's not just kidney cancer, but it's other cancers as well that are susceptible to this immune-based approach. So head and neck cancer, lung cancer, we're starting to see some signals in colon cancer in certain situations and other cancers. We never would have expected this to be effective. So it's a lot broader approach. We used to sit in the room, and I remember the first study we heard. We thought it was going to be a couple of, effective in melanoma.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the very first trials, all these other cancers started to show up as being impacted beneficially by the immune system, by these new immune therapies. And that was quite a surprise to some of us.
Was the response to the treatment, those particular tumors actually shrinking in size in response?
Yep. I actually remember, I write a blog from time to time. Don't do it as much now as I used to. Unfortunately, my time is just not my own as much as I would like it to be. Having said that, a couple of years ago at ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology annual meeting, which was one of the, if not the major cancer meetings in the world, they showed a picture of a 96-year-old lady with a head and neck cancer. And it was dramatic. And I wrote it up because it was so dramatic. And that cancer, 96 years old, got the immune therapy as part of a first phase clinical trial. And that tumor went away completely in 30 days. Now, I think most of the people in the audience were taken aback a little bit to see that. So, yes, I mean, these tumors can go away completely, but they can do something else that's interesting that we're still struggling with, and that is they can actually appear to progress even though they're responding. And sometimes the cancer, what appears to be the cancer, may grow a little bit and then stabilize over time, and then sometimes, and it may remain in that state for a long time, either as a cancer and not change at all, or it may actually leave behind what we're seeing is scar tissue.
Okay.
And it's real hard some occasionally to tell the difference. But what you do tell is the patients are generally doing better.
I see.
Now, with that, unfortunately, I always like to make sure we have a little bit more of the story. These treatments looked like they were not as, didn't have as many side effects. But over time, some other side effects have shown up where now the awakened immune system can attack other cells and other organs in our body.
Inflammatory type diseases, yes, like arthritis and
colon arthritis. You can get various organs in the body. Endocrine organs can be sort of attacked, shall we say. Mm-hmm. So yes, once you open up that immune system, sometimes it can overfunction and do some damage to organs that if you thought about it back then, you said this could happen, and now we're starting to see that occur. It's a source of real concern among the treatment community.
Well, being around the space as long as you have, you will have been able to really see the emergence and now I think it's fairly safe to say move to prominence of genetics in trying to identify, is this tumor related to another type of tumor that we've successfully treated with XYZ? That there's the notion of pharmacogenetics. I haven't seen it be penetrated very deeply into the cancer treatment medicines yet. I mean, tamoxifen, I know that there's some story there, but talk about your feeling about where we are with genetics as it relates to cancer.
In contrast to what you just said, it's a big deal in cancer treatment today. And it's a big deal. It's like there used to be a talk radio host named Sally Jesse Raphael. Mm-hmm. And she once said something to the effect, I may have the words wrong. It took me, I was an overnight success. It just took me 30 years to get there.
Yes.
And if you were if you're an oncologist, if you were practicing, or even if you were a researcher, you would sit and you would wait to hear the great news because you knew there's a lot of work going on. And we're talking, remember the war on cancer, 1971, and we're working away, and 1970 came and went, and 1980 came and went, and 1990 came and went. And then all of a sudden in 2000, there was a breakthrough drug, a drug called imatinib, or trade name is Gleevec, and chronic myelogenous leukemia, targeted therapy. Maybe that wasn't so much, it was genetic. It's an understanding of how the cancer cell worked and be able to target the cancer cell in a certain way. And that took almost essentially a uniformly fatal disease and converted it to almost a uniformly normal life cycle disease. As people who, the studies coming out now show, if not everyone, many of those patients with chronic myelogenous leukemia now live normal lifespans, which is pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
So, but long story, the research continues. So here we are today, and now as we're talking today, 2017, and we have so much better understanding of the human genome. The code has been cracked, so to speak. They're now turning out they can take your genes and they can run them through a machine and they can turn a result in, I don't know the number of days. I keep hearing different numbers, 10 days, 15 days, whatever it is, at a very reasonable cost. And they can decode the entire genome of a cancer, or they can take a blood sample. We're not perfect on that one yet, still research, but they can pick out the abnormal genetic markers that are in that blood sample. Or we can take a tumor and we can say, this tumor has this abnormality, genetic abnormality. We can target that abnormality. And then we can also see if resistance, if it's working its way around that particular target, around the treatment. Hmm. There's so many things that we can do. It's actually incredibly exciting. And some institutions around the country are now routinely doing genetic analyses on every cancer. And not only on the cancer cells, which what we call somatic. I don't want to get too detailed, but the changes in the cancer versus what we call germline, which is the stuff we inherit from our parents, mm-hmm. and make comparisons. And it goes on and on. We're finding family, changes among families. There used to be a family walk in and we know about BRCA now. We know about for breast cancer, mm-hmm. ovarian cancer, for pancreatic cancer, for prostate cancer. We know about that one, but now we're finding things we never even imagined before. Or we're finding how many people really have these fundamental germline mutations that predict cancer. So there's a lot going on, and there are going to be a lot of questions society has to deal with, whether everybody's going to routinely have their genome analyzed the time they're born. And that may not be too far off in the future, but we as a society, writ large society, we have to make that decision whether we're going to go that route or not, and how we're going to offer protections to people. So it's pretty spectacular. And there are a huge number of drugs in the pipeline, mm-hmm. taking advantage of this. And the question now is, how do we get all these drugs tested? How do we make sure everybody has access to these drugs? We actually have drugs, one that was just approved by, it was an existing drug, pembrolizumab, it was approved by the FDA for, not for a specific cancer, but for a genetic change that might occur in several cancers.
I see.
And you know, with the old days of looking under the microscope, you know, that old thing when the guy had the microscope.
Yeah, the pathology.
Finally would hook, it's called pathology, and say, yeah, that's a colon cancer, that's, yes, a lung cancer. Now, well, that's okay, but we're moving to an era where you can take that breast cancer, take that lung cancer, do the genetics, and you can find similarities to other tumors,
yes,
or you can find abnormalities within that cancer that will predict how it behaves. So it's very, yes, once again, I have to sort of hold myself back a little bit because I don't want to be over-promising and under-delivering like a lot of folks have done over the years, but it's really very exciting in my opinion.
Well, when it comes to research, talk about that a little bit because I know that's obviously one of the primary focuses of the Cancer Society is to foster and support various research around cancer treatments, all manners of facets of dealing with cancer. Where are we with research in terms of progress and things, you know, that you see that are showing some measure of promise and just what do you need as it relates to research? Who needs to step in and be a player as well to make more research happen? To do that, you talked about being able to achieve in 5 years in research what you could normally achieve in 10. The sense that I get is a couple of things are at play to make that happen. One is numbers, right? So if you can get the numbers, but yes.
Money and funding.
Yes.
Reliable continuing sources of funding, to be honest with you. There are a couple different questions there. I mean, so we can talk about clinical research, that is actually being able to move drugs forward from the lab, or what we call from the bench to the bedside, actually getting them to into the system, so to speak, to find out if they work and how much they help. Another part of research is finding patients who have these abnormalities wherever they may be, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But you know, the American Cancer Society, for example, since the 1940s, has committed over $4.5 billion to fundamental basic science research. That's been our niche. We've always felt that making sure that young investigators, bright, new, innovative ideas, have an opportunity to see the light of day. And we have the good fortune over a course of a number of years to have supported, you know, well over 40 Nobel Prize winners, you know, who at one point had funding from the American Cancer Society. That's critically important. And unfortunately, what's happening is the amount of funding, the amount of support for those researchers is dwindling. Government, you know, we know what goes on with the government. Money comes, money goes, money's right, tight, decisions are made. But if we don't continue to fund that infrastructure, those bright new ideas are going to go somewhere else. They may go to other countries, as a matter of fact. So China, for example, there are a number of articles I've seen recently coming out of China in basic research and applied research that, you know, China's making those investments because they view that as the future. And we are not doing as well as we should. So the American Cancer Society, for example, in concordance and as part of the Moonshot Initiative from Vice President Biden, is going to double our research efforts, trying to commit by 2021 to about $240, $250 million for basic science research. That's every year, and we commit to those investigators so they have a steady source of money. But the larger research efforts, and the government is the largest funder of cancer research, and not only in the country, but in the world, the U.S., the federal government. And you know, you just read the newspapers. Every year, Congress goes up, Congress goes down, Congress commits. Now, they've made some commitments recently for which we're all very grateful. But that's another source that has to be present. And the clinical piece, we have to find ways to better organize clinical research. You know, let's take an example here, what we could do here in Georgia. And we have a wonderful program. As part of that first interview you mentioned, Georgia Corps was here. Mm-hmm. Nancy Parrish, great, great group of folks, really. And Georgia is very fortunate to have them. But they encourage clinical trials in the state of Georgia. And the way, if you marry genomics, and you understand that you have these targets that may occur in a very, very small number of people. So, for example, some of the things we look at today are could be tried in 1% of the patients with lung cancer, 1%. So you can't, no one institution can get all those people. We've got to find, if a person has lung cancer, we need to find if they have that abnormality and if we can get them into a trial, no matter where they are in the state of Georgia. Mm-hmm. Finding those people where they are as part of an organized effort is important. And we do have the fundamental structure here in Georgia to be able to do that. So research takes on a lot of different points of view. Certainly, industry is willing to fund the clinical research to a degree, to a large degree. But the basic research, the innovative new ideas, the crazy lunatic stuff that doesn't sound like it would make any sense. I can tell you some lunatic stories that actually have saved thousands of lives. And, you know, it's only because somebody was there and somebody, you know, a young researcher had the willingness to commit, to continue, and that somebody was there to fund them. And I'm proud to say that sometimes that was the American Cancer Society. So, but there are others. There are many others that do that as well. And it's necessary, because if we don't do it today, if we don't continue that today, then 15, 20, we're not going to have all the answers today. Mm-hmm. 15, 20, 30 years from now, we'll still have more questions, and we'll get more answers. And we have to make sure we don't give up. We can't stop.
How are we doing now? We're obviously several decades into this effort. Clearly, there's some innovations, as we're describing, both the inclusion of genomic data, innovative and novel surgical approaches mm-hmm. that you can do nowadays, better delivery of radiation, all of those things. How are we doing? I mean, we realized, heck, smoking cigarettes, and we're getting people interested in it at an early age so they can do it all their life. And so obviously we changed those types of things to curb the rate of smoking. So for example, are we seeing trend lines appropriate to that lifestyle? Because so much of it is lifestyle, we know. Diet. How are we doing?
Well, we're not doing well enough. And one point that I think is always critical to point out to all of us need to remember this. There are still too many people, you know, they don't succeed in terms of getting the benefit of treatments. And that may be for a lot of reasons. They may not have access to care. They may not, you know, they may decide, and that's their decision, that they may not want care, but that's a different group. But there's still too many people who we can't help. And we should never, never forget that. With all the terrific news that comes out and makes everything so hopeful, there's still too many people who pass away, unfortunately. We know them. There may be some people who are in distress listening to this program. We understand that we have to do better. So that should always be top of mind in our commitments. You mentioned tobacco. We clearly have done much better in tobacco. And we're continuing to do better, but we're still have, you know, tobacco is a major cause of illness in this country. I mean, even here, I've lived in rural Georgia, and tobacco is, and the use of tobacco is still pretty heavy in mm-hmm. some of those communities yes. in our own state. And the impact, not just on cancer, but the impact on health is really a problem. And we have to be thinking about what we can do to change that. So yes, in answer to your question, more direct answer, that we say trend lines. The trend lines have gone down substantially for tobacco-related illnesses. They've gone down in all communities, so particularly in the African-American community. It mm-hmm. was when I started my medical career in Baltimore, I was stunned by the rate of lung cancer and other tobacco-related illnesses, and that community was targeted. It was absolutely targeted by the tobacco companies.
Yes.
And you know, they did get the message, and there has been a significant decline in that community and other communities around the country, ethnic communities, in terms of, you know, cancer-related illnesses that are secondary to tobacco, still could do much better. We have screening that has helped us reduce some the mortality for breast cancer, colon cancer, and we have better treatments for breast cancer and colon cancer that have also contributed. So we've had seen no question since 1990. Now, if you go from, you know, it depends where you start your line. And some people say, well, we haven't changed. And they go back to 1970. But if you go to 1990 and when things were going up, the situation was clearly getting worse, we have literally averted I believe the number now is about 1.6 million premature deaths. We can never, unfortunately, avert death. That's part of life. But premature deaths, yeah, we've averted. So there are people around today, I like to tell the story, who didn't get cancer. Never would have gotten cancer, don't even know they averted cancer, but in the old days may have had cancer, colon cancer, because, mm-hmm. for example, we can take polyps out and prevent a colon cancer.
Yes.
So you don't know if you ever would have had it or not. And our numbers are much better. On the other hand, we have some diseases like pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer. We have lung cancer still remains very difficult in smokers. And a lot of people, by the way, who get lung cancer are non-smokers. And we have to remember that as well. And we still are not doing anywhere near as well in treatment as we would like. Screening offers some hope, but to some degree, the jury's still out a little bit on lung cancer screening. We have to find out for sure how well it really works.
Mm-hmm. I know that more and more physicians are embracing the notion of prevention through screening for a different number of diseases, you know, looking more closely, getting aggressive the moment your glucose starts to rise rather than waiting till you're 126, things like that, you know what I'm saying? And I was one of the guests that was introduced to me as an internal medicine physician, Ronnie Smith, through the MAG show in Vidalia, Georgia, is very aggressive about ensuring that his patient population gets screened for colon cancer. And just this year, they prevented 53 colon cancers by identifying polyps you're talking about that were precancerous and being able to remove those simply without development of actual cancer from that. Because we're distributed through the MAG network, obviously a lot of our listeners are physicians. And if you were coming from the standpoint of the American Cancer Society, where you're trying to educate physicians and other clinicians, do you have thoughts around just the notion of screening? Because it's been kind of changing a little bit in different areas. What would you say?
Well, that's a very fascinating question, because for a number of years, I actually was managing the department within the American Cancer Society that set the screening guidelines. I don't do that anymore. And it was interesting to see how philosophies about screening have changed over time. Again, not to get too much in the weeds about decades, but when I started my medical career back in the 1970s, we really did believe that if we could find a cancer early, we would save every life. And I do have to say that I think that that belief has been or should be tempered over time, because we could find every cancer early and we didn't save every life. Or we went looking for cancers and the cancers came up in between the screening. So screenings are good. They're important for certain diseases. They're not perfect. And that's, you know, and treat. So both there's a multiple parts of the story. It's trying to prevent when you can prevent. It's to screen to find early when you can effectively screen to find early. And it's making sure when you find cancer that it gets properly treated. People have access to care in all of its dimensions, not just the matter of the surgery and not the, you know, the therapy, the chemotherapy or targeted therapies, but also the supportive therapies, the palliative care, what have you. That's what gives us the best opportunity. But, you know, we've learned a lot of lessons about screening. We've learned that, you know, mammography is you know, the whole question about, do we find cancers that may never cause harm during a lifetime? A source of great debate within the mammography community. Are we over-treating certain cancers? So we're now, there are research papers coming out where we're actually identifying women who may have a cancer, but it doesn't need to be treated. Or it needs to be treated, taken
Similar
out.
But to the men with prostate changes.
Well, the prostate's probably the best example I use. We wanted to believe that prostate cancer screening would save every man from prostate cancer. Yeah. It saved some lives. We still, to this day, don't know which lives it's saving for sure. We're still trying to figure that out. But we've also learned, as my anatomy professor told me back in 1971, walked into the class. Actually, it was not 1971, it was 1967. I got to get my year straight. Walked in the class and say, you're going to find prostate cancer in almost, if a man gets to a certain age and you do the dissection, you're going to find prostate cancer in almost every man if he gets to be 90 years old. Now, not everyone. So they knew that. But then the PSA test came along, and then the mantra was, we have to do it. So we operated on a lot of men. We saved some lives. We didn't save as many as we thought we saved. We did cause some harm to some men along the way. That's the lesson that we should not repeat. So today's equivalent is that we're moving in an era with what a blood test called cell-free DNA, where we're looking for fragments of cancer in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe, some people believe, that if we find those fragments at the very earliest moment, that we will save every life. Well, I don't think history, I do believe that history is going to repeat itself. Yes. I don't believe history has changed. And sometimes we're going to find fragments. And I do believe, I personally believe, as we find more of these opportunities, we're going to find more cancers that won't cause a problem. So critically important is parallel to understand which of those fragments make a difference and which ones don't. That's where we're headed. And I once had Susan Love tell me on the Today Show on NBC TV, she reacted in horror when I said that back in 2009. She said, we're going to make everybody a cancer survivor. And I went to her a couple of years ago, said, Susan, I think you're right. And I think the critical part is be able to find those fragments, know where they came from, and be able to tell if they made a real difference. Because otherwise we will be scaring a whole lot of people unnecessarily. Sure. And that's part of this trend that's gone on over time. So yes, screening is important. Breast mammography, breast cancer screening, cervical cancer screening remains important. The recommendations change, but you have to still do something periodically. Colon cancer screening is important. Lung cancer screening, you need to understand the benefits, risks, and opportunities with lung cancer screening. And if you want it, you should be able to get it. And we'll learn more about that over time. But the PSA also, we do believe what we call shared decision making. Understand the benefits, risks, and what may be the outcome of prostate cancer screening. And if it's our recommendation, if you want to do it, do it. But we, you know, it's a lot of it's lifestyle. Tobacco. Tobacco is number one. I mean, tobacco wouldn't talk about health. Talk about health. And now obesity, of course, is becoming a major issue as well. And that's, you know, the prediction that some of us have said is that obesity will be the new tobacco. And that also increases the risk. But that's these are tough questions. Tobacco's not easy to get off of tobacco.
Right.
Obesity, it's not, you know, I can tell you from personal experience, go try to lose weight.
Yes.
Been there, done that.
Yeah.
I know.
Seriously.
And it takes a lot of effort. And just getting on the elliptical for an hour every morning just doesn't do it. You got it's different. We all know, people listening all know that.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean you don't give up the ghost. You keep trying. every day you try to be better. You will fail many days. You will succeed on some days. And ultimately, and try to do what you can to take care of yourself, because ultimately trying to live a long, healthy life is important. And I have to understand, just because you do everything right doesn't mean you escape the problems. I mean, you can't get to perfection. You never can. But when you talk about large numbers of people, we can do better.
Mm-hmm. Now, for our physician listeners out there or other clinicians that are taking care of patients dealing with cancers, can you share information about where they can go? There's Georgia CORE, Georgia Cancer Info. Obviously, I'm sure that the cancer.org also has some information about clinical trials.
Well, cancer.org, and we also have a call center that's available 24/7.
Okay.
And that number is 800-227-2345. 800-227-2345. So, yes. We have a clinical trial matching service. We can take information, but you know we're moving. What we've got, when you talk about clinical trials, there's a lot of technology solutions that are out there now that are trying to do it seamlessly, because a lot of patients unfortunately call and they say, I want to know about clinical trial, but they sometimes don't even know the name of their disease.
Correct.
Or they don't know the stage of their disease, or they don't know all the blood tests. So we've got to find, and docs are pretty busy. You know, we're talking about screening and prevention. There have been studies that have been out a long time ago, and they're still valid, even more so today, from primary care folks. If they did everything they're supposed to do to try to do prevention, they wouldn't have enough hours in the day. So we've got to find more seamless solutions. We've got to find other ways of approaching these issues, and clinical trials is another one. So when a patient has cancer, we need to be able to seamlessly find out, you know, in the background, through, you know, using health information technology, and those solutions exist to try to make it a little bit easier for everybody. Because a busy clinician is exactly that, a busy clinician. You know, if we're going to make this work and really make it work, if we're going to make that Biden moonshot promise of 10 years to 5 years, we got to be able to find people where they are when they need our help.
Well, I'm pleased to have had you in the studio with us today. Clearly, we've got plenty more, I'm sure. We'll have to have you back, and we can do this periodically to talk about various aspects of where things are going with cancer research, as well as other treatments and therapies that are available to patients that it would be beneficial for the community to know more about. So I'd love to have you back. If you've not done so already, make sure you subscribe to the Top Docs Radio Show podcast. That way, when the new episodes come out, they're downloaded to your device. You can check them out when it's convenient for you, and turn around and push this out on LinkedIn and Facebook and other social media platforms. You may just be putting some information in the hands of somebody that means something to you that makes a big difference for them, and all you did was click share. So if you do that for us, thank you very much in advance, and appreciate you making time. It's not always easy to get in here to the studio, so I'm glad to have you.
Well, it's a real pleasure, and hope we can do this again.
Everybody out there who made us a part of your day, thanks so much. Thanks to our partners at the Medical Association of Georgia. We'll see you next time.